In Joshua chapter 6, and the title of the message today is Jericho, the First Fruit. And when we look at Jericho, Jericho has been looming in front of the Israelites since they crossed the Jordan River. And Jericho exerted a mighty influence in the region of Canaan here that they're coming across. And this influence of this city. Now, when we look at these cities that we're going to conquer in the book of Joshua, all of these cities are city-states. In other words, each of the cities have a king, and they exert their own control over their own authority. And so it's a city-state. And so they come in, and that's why there's a king living in the city. He's the king over this region. And Jericho would have influenced the entire region, probably 15 miles or so eastward across the Jordan River to where the Israelite camp was situated, and eastward from there into the plains of Moab. And so it had a lot of importance in the region and in the area. It wasn't a particularly big city, but it was very fortified. It was a huge fortress. And so up to this point in the Israelites' life, everything's been preliminary and preparatory for today. We've been looking at the preparation for the last several weeks. And it's amazing how before God lets you move into the battle, he does a lot of heart prep, doesn't he? He does a lot of work in us to get us ready for the real task now that's before the children of Israel. They have to now face their enemy, and they have to tackle it. They have to begin to move into what God has called them to move into. And so the Canaanites have to be dispossessed if Israel's going to take over what God has promised to them. And so if Israel could defeat Jericho, their most formidable enemy they're going to face, then they can defeat any other enemy they're going to find in their life. And this is the beautiful thing about God in our lives. He allows us to have a victory that lends itself to the next victory and lends itself to the next victory. You remember when David took on Goliath, and one of the things he said there, hey, I've killed a lion and I've killed a bear. And he actually said, I grabbed the lion by the beard and killed him. And who's this uncircumcised Philistine in front of me? I'm going to take him out too with the power of the Lord. There's a building of faith that happens in our lives. And as we grow in faith, it gives us power and ability to have the next victory. And that's what God's doing here. And this is God's design. I'm going to bring you to the biggest, baddest enemy first. And everybody else is going to seem like a piece of cake, a cakewalk in the future. Well, look at verse 1 here. Now Jericho was securely shut up because the children of Israel, none went out and none came in. Now, when you look here, Jericho's on full alert. And with a city shut up behind the walls, soldiers behind the walls, the entire area, all of the community around the city, everybody would have come into the city for protection, and they locked this thing up, and everybody, they've shut it up tight, probably since Israel came across the Jordan River. And so Jericho itself in this situation would be hard, if not impossible, to take the city down. And so from a human perspective, the city was shut up tight, and it would take a long time to breach the gates and penetrate the city. And Jericho's strength was in its walls. Let's look at a little graphic here of Jericho. Notice there that there's double walls around it. There's two sets of walls. This is why it was maintained its strength for so long. You had to knock down two walls. Now when you look at the story of the walls falling down, you realize, wow, God did a double miracle by taking both sets of walls down completely. So here we see how hard it would be to take down this city with just the work of man's strength or man's ability or man's wisdom. And though it was small in diameter, it possessed an extremely heavy fortifications that could have easily survived a siege of a year or more. So, you know, Joshua could be standing there going, oh my gosh, this is going to be a whole year it's going to take to knock this thing down and to win the victory. But yet from God's perspective, and that's how we always want to see things, right? From God's perspective, the battle was already over. That's the beautiful thing about God. The battle was already over. He had a radically different plan. Now, you remember back in chapter 5, verse 14, if you look back there real quick, remember when last week we saw that Joshua's out looking at the wall and he's trying to figure out, wow, what would be God's strategy here? How would he want to do this? And while he's there looking. That man comes behind him, in front of him, with a sword drawn, ready to fight. And Joshua says, hey, are you for us or our enemies? And he just says, no, I'm the commander of the Lord's army. In other words, as we saw last week, are you on my side, Joshua? I'm going to be the one doing something for you. Look at verse 14. Here's what he said he's going to do for him. As commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. So this pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus, most likely here, and this person here, he's coming. He's saying, listen, I've come now. And what did Joshua do? He fell on his face to the earth, and he worshiped, and he said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? Here Jesus comes, and he's ready to come for him. And who does he say he is? He's the captain of the Lord's army. Here's what Jesus is saying to him for our battle today. Israel's army is not the only army that's going to be fighting Jericho. Israel's army is not the only army that's going to fight for their cause. The army of the Lord was already fighting for Israel. It was already at war, just getting things ready. How do we know that? Because the city was shut up tight. We look back in chapter 5 and it says all of the hearts of the kings had already melted, that all the courage went out of them. They were behind the walls shaking with fear, but Joshua couldn't know that. Joshua couldn't know that they were back there just scared of what was going to happen. Where's the move? Where's it coming from? And in their mind, they're probably going, hey, the gates are the most vulnerable part of our city, so let's put all of our work behind that. Let's get that ready, and so it'll sustain an attack. When you think about Jericho, you have to remember here, for 40 years, they're hearing about Israel coming, and for 40 years, they get to build up the defenses of their city. So the enemy here has entrenched himself, set himself in, and he's ready to hold his ground and hold his territory. And this is what we find in our lives too, don't we? When we begin to go into the promises of God, the enemy comes in and goes, no, I'm not going to give that up. I'm going to provoke all those areas in your life and keep you in that place. I'm going to hold out the promise of hope and satisfaction, but I'll never deliver it. But I'm not going to give up the ground. That's when the fight begins, doesn't it? When we choose to follow Jesus, that's when the fight starts. When we choose to step into the land, that's when the battle begins. Why? Because the enemy doesn't want to give up the ground. When we think about our enemy in our life, who is the devil and the world and all the flesh that we have inside of us, this old sin nature, they're all in alignment with each other. Our old nature loves what the devil loves. Our old nature loves what the world loves. So we have this thing in us that's just drawn to all of the things that are against us, and they want to stay entrenched in our life. How long have they been laying their fortifications? Well, since the beginning of time, 6,000 years. That's a lot of fortification, right? And how long have you been alive? That's how long those fortifications have been trying to be built up in your life. So when we step into faith, when we go into the work, that's when the fight starts. But what we see is that the commander of the Lord's army comes in and the enemy is already afraid. Listen, we've got to understand this morning as a church. The enemy's afraid of the church. He's afraid of the church. Why? Because we have so much power. Because our commander is the commander of the Lord's army. And how does he divide the power? That's exactly how he does it. He divides it, and that's where he brings things into church and just keeps dividing, so that there's not a unity where we all experience power because we're all at each other instead of being together in the mission that God's called us to. And so this is his tactic that he brings in with us. He's the deceiver. He's the divider. He's all of these things that we know him to be. So what we see here is Joshua falls on his face to the earth, and he worshiped the commander. He worshiped Jesus. And he was to submit to the commander first and then to his plan. You know, it's interesting in our day and age because we often want to know God's plan. What's God's plan? What's God's plan? You know, that's probably the number one question. How do I know God's will? What's God's plan? What does he want me to do? How do I get there? How do I experience it? Here we see that it's more important for us to recognize God's position in our lives than God's plan in our lives. And Joshua recognizes Jesus' position in his life by getting on his face and worshiping him. It puts him in the place of control over his life. And that's a hard place to be because that means death to self in all those areas that you're surrendering. And isn't that the game we play with the Lord oftentimes? Is we'll only surrender so much because we have those pet sins and those pet weights in us that we love to hang on to, and we justify them in our life. Joshua's like, everything's laid aside, no plans of mine. They're all yours, Lord. And the position is this: I'm not the general of this army, you are. And that's how we view the church. This church here, we view it as Jesus Christ is the senior pastor. And we are his under rowers, and we're here to do his will. He's the commander. So the commander of the Lord's army is going before you, Joshua. The army of the Lord is engaging in the battle for you. That's what you need to know first. Now look at verse 2. Verse 2 really is just a continuation of what we saw in chapter 5. In fact, verse 1 is really a parenthetical thought. As Jesus begins to talk to Joshua, just in parenthetically, the writer says, oh, and by the way, here's the condition in the city. And now we get to continue the conversation with Jesus here in verse 2. And the Lord said to Joshua, see, I've given Jericho into your hand, its king and the mighty men of valor. God's methodology is frequently like this, isn't it? Greater obstacles for his people call forth greater mighty help from God. Even though we have to admit sometimes, nothing looks quite so unlikely as the plan of God. You guys ever just receive from the Lord a plan and you're like, really? Okay, you know, let's go for it. And that's what we're looking for. That's what we're wanting God to do with us. But notice what Jesus says to him. See? See what? I see a city locked up. I see an impenetrable fortress. I see a people ready to defend themselves, ready to defend their homeland. What am I supposed to see, Lord? Everything I see tells me the victory is impossible. Everything I see tells me the victory can't be won. The walls can't be breached. We can't get inside. What do you mean, see? Notice Jesus here. He goes, look, check it out. See, I've given Jericho into your hand. What did Jesus want him to see? He comes and he says, listen, I'm the commander of the Lord's army. See the army. It's like, I can't see the army. Right, it's invisible. But it's here, and it's working on your behalf. Listen, this is why you're going to know I'm going to give you the city. It's impossible for you, but not for who I am. Now, we have a story in the Bible in 2 Kings chapter 6. And you remember when Syria was coming down and the king of Aram there came down and brought his armies down because he wanted to get Elisha. Every time the king of Aram, the king of Syria, was coming to attack Israel, God would tell Elisha where he was, and he would go to the king and go, hey, stay out of that valley because that's where he's setting up camp. To the point where the king of Syria said, hey, who's the spy? Who's the spy in the camp? Keeps telling the king of Israel where we're going to be. And they said, no, there's not a spy. It's Elisha, the man of God. And God would speak to him and he would report it. So this guy comes and he goes, hey, let's go down and get that guy. Let's go get him. And so they move their whole army around him and they go to attack him. Well, we see here that the servant gets up in the morning, walks out of his tent or out of the house, and there were troops and chariots everywhere. They're surrounding him. It's an impossible situation. And of course, he freaks out and he goes, whoa, and he runs back in and he tells Elisha, sir, what will we do now? We're dead. We're toast. Notice what he says in 2 Kings 6:16. Elisha says this to him. Don't be afraid, Elisha told him, for there are more on our side than on theirs. Elisha here, walking by faith, seeing and knowing what God's plan was. There's more on our side than on theirs. Look at verse 17. Then Elisha prayed, oh Lord, open his eyes and let him see. And the Lord opened the young man's eyes, and when he looked up, he saw that the hillside around Elisha was filled with chariots and horses and chariots of fire. The spiritual realm, we don't always see it, but we believe that God is working on our behalf. And here, God, you know, Elisha, he's just hanging out. He's like, who's outside? 10,000 soldiers? Whatever. Why? Because God told me what he was going to do. I don't have to be afraid. And he comes in, the servant comes in, and he's all worked up. And he's like, what do we do? And he's like, Lord, open his eyes to see. And when he opens his eyes, he's like, oh my gosh. And I bet you in that moment, his servant settled down, started making some breakfast and hanging out. Why? Because Elisha's like, listen, God's fiery chariots are all around the army that's all around us. He's not going to let us get defeated. And he's not going to let us be taken down. Can you imagine walking with God to that degree, to know exactly where he's positioned his forces, where he's put his troops on our behalf? I was praying this morning, and I was just picturing up here in these rafters and these trusses here that there's demons and angels hanging out, and, you know, maybe even fighting on the roof and battling as we go in to enter into the Lord, that there's a spiritual warfare that's taking place. And God, I believe, brings his angels, and they abide with us, and they watch what we're doing. But Paul tells us that in Corinthians, that they're watching what we're doing. They're interested in what's happening in the church. And here we see that when he opened his eyes, all of the chariots of fire were around the army. And this is what Jesus is saying to Joshua. Listen, you're going to take the city. See? Look. Open your eyes. The armies of the Lord are encamped around this city, and they're going to take the city down for you. So we see here's the command now in verse 3 and 4. You shall march around the city, all you men of war. You shall go all around the city once. And this you shall do 6 days. And the seven priests that bear the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. But the seventh day you shall march around the city 7 times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. Notice the command here. You shall march around the city. What are they going to do? All the men of war are going to go around the city once, do this for 6 days. 7 priests are going to bear the 7 trumpets. The 7 in the Bible here is the number of completion. When you study out the number in the Bible, it's the number of completion. Notice on the 7th day, on the 7th time around, the 7 priests are going to blow the 7 trumpets. And so here's Jesus now. After Joshua's worshiped him, after he's showed who he is, he goes, here's my battle plan. Just walk around the city. And what does this do? We saw already last week that when they came across the river, and the very first thing God did was, I want all the men, all the fighting men, all the men of age circumcised. And he took them out of commission. Remember that? They became very vulnerable in that time. They couldn't fight. Now they're healed and they're ready to go, and they've armed up. They come to the city and they're like, we're going to have a fight. And God and Jesus says, here's the fight I want you to have. Get all the men of war and then just walk around the city and walk around the city and walk around the city. Do that 6 days in a row. The vulnerability we saw when they were circumcised repeats itself here in the vulnerability of walking around the bottom of a wall while an entire army is on top. Notice the vulnerability there. They're walking, and the guys on top, you know, it's like, hey, let's just start taking them out. Let's start throwing things at them. Let's start working against them. Let's kill some of them now while we have the opportunity. But again, what was God doing? He was holding them back in fear while his children went and did the work God called them to do. Now, this method of warfare made absolutely no sense militarily, does it? And it's an incredible step of faith for Joshua and the people who are being called to take here by Jesus. It required total dependence upon God. It required great faith from Joshua because he had to lead the nation in this plan. It required great faith from the elders because they had to follow Joshua in this plan. It required great faith from the people because Israel would be open to attack during this time. And so we see God again. What's he doing? You're in a vulnerable position. You're open to attack, but you're strong in the might of the Lord. You're moving at his command. And when you're living a life of faith following Jesus, you're invincible. Nobody can touch you. So it would have been easy for the people of Jericho to attack them and do this. And so God says, walk around the city, blowing 7 trumpets, carrying the Ark of the Covenant. And it's a plan again for victory that clearly would be the work of the Lord. Now look at the promise that Jesus makes here in verse 5. And it shall come to pass when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, and all the people shall shout with a great shout, then the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go up every man straight. Here Jesus says, here's my plan, Joshua. You're going to go around the city 1 time a day for 6 days, but on the 7th day, you're going to go around the city 7 times. And after you've made the 7th trip around, the trumpets are going to be blown with a long blast, and the people are going to shout. And when the people shout, then the wall is going to fall. Notice the promise here. The promise is, if you go walk, I'll tear the wall down. If you'll step out in faith and obedience, I'll take care of the enemy. if you'll do what I called you to do, it shall come to pass, there in verse 5, that the very thing you're hoping for God to do will happen. He'll begin to work in a brand new way, tear down those walls in front of you, and do the work he's promised to do in you, but you've got to do it his way. You've got to pick up how he wants you to, not in your own strength, not in your own wisdom, not in your own ability, but in his will, his strength, his ability. And what do? You're going to march around the city. That's your act of obedience. I got my sword, I polished it up. It's like, yeah, just wait. You're not going to be in the battle, but you will be in the mop-up work that's going to happen afterwards. You're going to go reap the harvest. Notice verse 5, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people will shout with a great shout, then the wall of the city will fall down. Joshua's hearing the plan right now for the first time. Still a conversation between Jesus and him. And Joshua's hearing the plan, and you got to wonder, man, it's like, wow. But he saw the Red Sea open. He saw the River Jordan open. He saw God do what God does. He's piled up his stones. He's got all of his memorials in place. And so he's like, wow, God, again, you boggle my mind because you do things I could never dream you would do, in ways that I never dreamed you would do them. And here Joshua, he's just listening to this unbelievable plan with an unbelievable result, and a seeming unbreakable strength of the enemy will fall before you. So the army of the Lord knocks the wall down, and the children of Israel simply do what? Verse 5, they're just going to go straight up and take the city. Look at verse 8. So it was when Joshua spoke to the people that the priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord advanced and blew the trumpets, and the ark of the covenant of the Lord followed them. The armed men went before the priests who blew the trumpet, and the rear guard came after the ark while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. Notice when Joshua spoke to the people. Here, what do we see in Joshua? This is something that you see over and over again. Joshua doesn't hesitate to do what the Lord has told him to do. He doesn't wait. He immediately goes and tells the leaders, and he goes and tells the people. So, and what does he tell him? I'm going to tell you the strange method God is laying before us today. Notice this, the armed men before the priests who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the ark while the priests continued blowing the trumpet. The formation of the battle is soldiers in front, soldiers in the rear. And the center formation are the priests bearing the ark, blowing the trumpets. What's the picture God's presenting here, not only to Israel, but to the enemies? God is in the center of the battle. God's in the center. He's the focus. Remember when we crossed the sea, the Jordan River? God in the Ark of the Covenant was in the center of the story. He was in the center of the crossing. Here he's in the center of the battle. And the presence of God is what will make a difference for the Israelites in the battle. Look at verse 10. Now Joshua commanded the people, saying, you shall not make any noise with your voice, nor shall a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I say to you, shout, then you shall shout. Notice the people are not allowed to shout. They're not allowed to make a noise with their voices until Joshua gives the command to shout. Now look how present God is in the battle, but look how passive the people are. They're just recipients of the plan of God. They're not engaged at all. In fact, they're to remain silent as God works on their behalf. Now it's interesting, in Exodus 14:14, we saw this before they crossed the Red Sea, don't we? Here's what Moses said to them. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. You remember in that situation, as they're coming and they're going to cross over the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba there, and God turns them down to Pi-Hahiroth and brings them down along the edge and then traps them in the wadis of Egypt there as the Egyptian army is pursuing them, and they're at the Red Sea and they have nowhere to go. And they start crying out, why didn't you leave us there? They're going to kill us out here. And Moses comes and he says, listen, the Lord's going to fight for you, but you're going to keep silent. It's not a fear here. It's not a concern here as God moves on our behalf. And we know the story there of what happened. And the same thing's going to happen here. Joshua says, listen, you're going to go without a sound. You're not going to make a shout. You're not going to talk. You're not going to do anything. You're to be quiet before the Lord and let God do his work. And you're going to remain silent. So notice in verse 11, he had the ark of the Lord taken around the city, circling it once. And they came back into the camp, spent the night in the camp. So look at the next days, 12 to 14. Joshua rose early in the morning, and the priests took up the ark of the Lord. The seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark of the Lord went on continually and blew the trumpets. And the armed men went before them, but the rear guard came after the ark of the Lord while the priests continued blowing the trumpets. And the second day they marched around the city once and returned to the camp, and so they did 6 days. And so notice, Joshua rises early in the morning. He's in full obedience. The very first thing, let's go get it. Let's go do what God's called us to do. And they do this for 6 days. And so the picture here is the army gathers up, the priests gather up, the seven priests with the trumpets are in front of the ark, the ark's there, the rear guard's there, let's move out, and the priests are just blowing the trumpet nonstop the whole trip around. And you can imagine inside the city what's happening. Here they come. Get to the gates. Oh, wait, they passed the gate. Let's get to the other side. You can imagine inside, God's just moving their army around. Like, what's going to happen? And then they come to day two, and the same thing happens. And you got to imagine eventually they're up there having coffee, looking at them. Here they go on their round-the-city tour, you know. And every day that's happening, and you got to wonder, when are they going to strike? When are they going to strike? And then the seventh day approaches. Look at verse 15. But on the seventh day, they rose early about the dawning of the day, and they marched around the city seven times in the same manner. On that day only, they marched around the city seven times. And look at verse 16. And the seventh time, on the seventh day, the seven priests blew the trumpet, and Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." We have this buildup to this place, and we see again the number seven is the number of completion, and God is making something clear. The number six in the Bible is always the number of man. Man's created on the sixth day. The Antichrist, when he comes, he's going to have the number of man, 666. Six is always man's ability. Seven is always God's ability. It's his finished work, right? And on the seventh day, what was man supposed to do? Rest in God's finished work. Very first day of his life was rest in the Sabbath. Here, what does God do on the Sabbath day? He moves his children around the city seven times, actually breaking, technically, the Sabbath. And when they go around on that seventh time, Joshua finally says, "Here it is." The priests blow the horn. Woo! And he's like, "Shout!" And the seventh time it happened there in verse 16. And the seventh time it happened. Something the Lord put on my heart this morning as I was looking at this and reading this. The seven's a number of completion. And the seventh time it happened. There's a story that stuck out to me here in 1 Kings chapter 18. You remember when Elijah prayed and it didn't rain for 3 years? And then James tells us, then he prayed again and it did rain, and it sounded like, he prayed and it stopped, and he prayed and it rained. One thing the Lord was impressing on me this morning is that this story in 1 Kings 18, Ahab wanted rain, and so he goes to Ahab and he goes, "Hey, eat and drink. There's a sound of rain in the air." Speaking prophetically, there is no rain. It hasn't rained for 3.5 years. So Ahab went and ate and drank, and Elijah went to the top of Mount Carmel, and he bowed down to the ground and put his face between his knees. Listen, what was the position that Joshua took with Jesus? It was face down on the ground. What's the position Elijah takes with God? It's face down on the ground. Maybe some of our prayers aren't being answered because we're not face down on the ground before the Lord. And it's not a physical thing. It could be. It's a heart thing. It's a heart issue. Is your heart bowing down before the Lord? Is your heart on its face before the Lord? But I want you to see something here. In 1 Kings 18, when we go back and read the actual story, notice what it says in verse 43. And he said to his servant, "Go up now, look towards the sea." And he went up and looked and said, "There's nothing." And notice, and seven times he said, "Go again." What's seven, the number of in the Bible? Completion. So he's praying and he gets down on his face, "Lord, bring rain. You said you would bring rain. If we repented, we're repenting. Bring rain. Hey, go see if there's any rain. I see nothing. Lord, I pray again." He prayed seven times. And at the end of the seven times, notice in verse 44, it came to pass the seventh time. Isn't this the same language we see walking around the wall? And the seventh time, that's when the answer came. In the seventh time, he said, "There's a cloud as small as a man's hand." It He's out over the sea. He's out over the Mediterranean Sea. He goes out and looks. He goes, hey, I think I see something. There's just a little tiny cloud. And notice what he says. Get up, say to Ahab, prepare your chariot. Go before the rain overtakes you. Seven times. What do we see in this? Not that we have to pray seven times, but we have to pray to completion of the answer. There's many of us that are not experiencing answers to prayer because we're not enduring in prayer to the answer. And that's what God is teaching the nation of Israel here. You're going to go at my command, at my amount of time, at my prescribed requirement, and you're going to keep believing in me until the wall falls down, until the answer comes. You're going to be like Elijah. And we have this in James chapter 5. It says, Elijah was a man with a nature exactly like ours. What's the encouragement there? We can pray like Elijah prayed. It says there, the fervent, effective prayer of a righteous man avails much. Prayer is the key. Notice this. And the seventh time it happened, what does Joshua say? Shout. The Lord has given you the city. Notice this. They had to shout before the walls fell. That was their part. When did Elijah tell his servant, go tell him the rain's going to overtake him? When he saw something the size of a man's hand. How can that water an entire nation? But it did. That thing grew and overtook him. Listen, God answers our prayers sometimes before we ever see the answer, but calls us to shout in thanksgiving and praise, and then we see it happen in our lives. There's times we don't yet see the wall fall, but God says, you've got the answer. I don't see a change, Lord. I don't see anything happening. Begin to praise me. Begin to thank me, and you'll see it fall. Now, here we are. Shout, for the Lord is giving you the city. Now look at verse 17. Now the city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction. It and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in her house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. And you by all means abstain from the accursed things, lest you become a curse when you take the accursed things and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. But all the silver and gold and the vessels of bronze and iron are consecrated to the Lord. They shall come into the treasury of the Lord. Now, notice what the writer is doing here. He's constructing for us a delayed climax in the story. He's been building it. Here we go. We're walking. We're going. 7 days. Here we are, the seventh time around. Shout, guys, the Lord's given you the land. And then he stops the narrative and he inserts verses 17 to 19. Why does he do this? Because again, as we saw before, these are the most important things to God in the story, okay? The walls falling down are awesome. The miracle God does is awesome. But here's the miracle God wants to focus on. Right here in the middle, he stops you and he goes, hey, here's the important thing. It's almost like you're watching your favorite TV show and they say, we interrupt this program to bring you a special announcement. But there's something important happened that I'm interrupting the story to give you the highlight of what's important to God. So what's important to God? He's going to look at two, he's going to show two things here, the cursed and the consecrated. First, we see the cursed people. Look at verse 17. The city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, it and all who are in it. All people are cursed. Time's up. Judgment is here. And God is using the Israelites to bring judgment upon the Canaanites. Now, I'm just going to mention that a lot of people struggle with the Old Testament God because they're like, the God of Old Testament, he's a God of wrath. He just kills everybody, has everybody killed. Where's the love in that? Let's look at the love of God here real quick. Genesis 15, 16. This is when he's promising Abraham he's going to get the land. But notice, in the fourth generation they shall return here. Notice, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. He promises Abraham, your kids are going to inherit the land, but they're not going to inherit the land for four generations. That's 400 years. And he explains that the reason they weren't going to do that is because the land is defiled. Look at Leviticus chapter 18, verse 25. For the land is defiled, therefore I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out his inhabitants. What's God doing? When we look at the story here, we see that there's 400, it tells us in Exodus 12, 40, that they were in Egypt for 430 years, and you add 40 years in the wilderness. So now 470 years of God's patience with a people that he's calling to repent. For 470 years, God is making himself known in Canaan to some degree, and probably through creation, we see in Romans chapter 1 that all of creation shares and displays who God is. And if you'll respond to creation, God will give you the special revelation of how to come to know him. So for 470 years, these people get more wicked and more wicked and more wicked, and God is waiting for them to repent. They don't repent. So now, the judgment time. And that's why it looks like God is harsh, because he's now going in, hey, kill everybody, kill everything. And that's pretty harsh, isn't it? But we also see here the cursed things. Look at verse 18. And you by all means abstain from the accursed things, lest you become a curse when you take of the accursed things and make the camp of Israel a curse and trouble it. Listen, Joshua commanded the people here to do what? Stay away from the accursed things. What are the accursed things? This word accursed means something that's under a curse. And by this he means the idols and the depraved worship, the demonic worship of all of the people, and sexual worship of all the people of Canaan. You get an insight in here going, listen, here's what God is important to God, is obedience of his people to his command. And then we see here, here's the other thing we see about God. He judges sin. He judges sin. It's very important that we understand this, that God hasn't changed today. He still judges sin. Look at here also, the consecrated things. We have the cursed things, we have the consecrated things in verse 19. But all the silver, the gold, the vessels and bronze and iron are consecrated to the Lord. All the valuables belong to God. Jericho's the first fruit city of Canaan, and so the valuables are set apart to the treasury of the Lord. The first fruits, there's a principle of first fruits in the Bible that always belong to the Lord. The feast of first fruits that we looked at last week, you remember what they had to do? We see it in Leviticus 23:11. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord. It shall be accepted on your behalf. On this day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. The day after what Sabbath? The Sabbath that came after the Passover. And what was that day? The exact same day Jesus Christ rose from the dead and became the first fruit offering of all who are going to rise from the dead. Jesus is our first fruit offering. He rose from the dead, so that proves what? We will also rise from the dead. And that's what Jericho is here to God. He's like, listen, the first one is mine. Nobody else can touch it. You're either going to kill everything or you're going to give all the valuables to me. There's no other choice. Nobody's to touch anything. And so we see the consecrated things, but also here we see what God's pointing out to us is consecrated people. Look at verse 17 there. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. Rahab was consecrated to God. He saved her and all who believed with her. Remember the story when we looked in chapter 2. So the mercy of God, not just the judgment of God is the focus. What's the other focus? The mercy of God. God is declaring something about himself. He's declaring that he's a God of mercy. And the God of mercy and the picture of the God of mercy is more important in the story than the victory itself. The walls falling down, almost it's a side conversation. It's like, oh yeah, and by the way, the walls fell down and they burned everything. Here's the focus. God's a God of mercy. God's a God of wrath. That's the focus. And that's who God is. And we don't like that God all the time, don't we? Do we? What do? We try to create a God in our own image, after our likeness. A God that agrees with our viewpoints and our lifestyles. But God says, no, that's not me. If you want to follow me, come to my mercy and find forgiveness. Look at verse 22. But Joshua said to the two men who spied out the country, go into the harlot's house and from there bring out the woman and all that she has as you swore to her. And the young men who had been the spies went in and brought out Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all she had. And they brought out all her relatives, left them outside the camp. And Joshua spared Rahab, the harlot, her father's household, and all that she had. And so she dwells in Israel to this day. Isn't that beautiful? Here we see the contrast between judgment and salvation. All of Jericho heard about the God of Israel, but only Rahab responded in faith towards the God with that knowledge. Rahab and her loved ones are rescued from destruction and begin a new life with the people of God. Listen, here's the reality. In 470 years, only one family repented. They all heard the same message. They all saw the same God. They all saw the same miracles. Only one family ran to the mercy of God. And so God says everybody else dies. Rahab feared God and she ran to his mercy. Here's a principle God tells us in Jeremiah 18:8. If that nation against whom I spoke turns from its evil, I will relent from the disaster that I thought to bring upon it. Listen, if we will repent, even if destruction has been declared against you, God will relent and he'll save you through his mercy. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 18 says this: we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope that is set before us. Who's the hope? Jesus Christ. We saw Jesus and we said, I want that. And we run after him and we cling to him like a refuge. And it says there, he's a hope before us. And the next verse says this: that anchor of hope is steadfast and holds our life of faith. That's Jesus. And we've run to him for mercy, haven't we? And so this pagan woman, her entire household, they stand now in the circle of God's chosen people. Matthew 1, 5 and 6, you remember? She becomes a participant in the line of King David and ultimately to Jesus Christ himself. God's mercy is so powerful, so redeeming, so cleansing, so healing, so transforming. He takes this pagan harlot and turns her into a person who actually God allows King David to come from her, and along the line, actually King Jesus comes from her line. It's beautiful. You got Rahab, who was in a city called, declared destruction in Canaan. You've got Ruth, who the Moabites were also. God told them to wipe them out. Both of these women, by faith, received God and followed God, and God puts them right in the line with Jesus Christ. What will God do with you if you turn to Jesus? What will he do with you? He'll transform your old life into a brand new life. And he'll do it through his mercy and his grace. So God takes this middle picture here and he goes, hey, I got you. I got your attention. We're, the walls, the people are going to shout here in a minute. But while I have your attention, let me show you what's most important to me, my judgment and my mercy. That's the most important. And now we come back to verse 20, and now notice what it says. So the people shouted when the priest blew the trumpet. And it happened when the people heard the sound of the trumpet and the people shouted with a great shout that the wall fell down and all the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they took the city. Notice this, the wall fell flat, just like God said. The trumpet blew, the people shouted, then the wall came down. And then the people went up into the city, and they took the city. Look at verse 21. And they utterly destroyed all that was in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. Severe judgment that God brings against Jericho and Canaan didn't come because they were in the way of God's people. The destruction came because his people were in total rebellion against God. This people were in total rebellion against God and in league with the occult and with artifacts recovered from the period when they go through and dig through the area now. It's a lot of occultic material and demon worship and everything else. But Deuteronomy 9:5, here's what God says about this. It's not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you go in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord your God drives them out from before you. God dispossessed the nations that would not yield to God, that were unwilling to repent, that were unwilling to submit to God. And so God destroyed them. And notice what they do in verse 24. They burn the city and all that was in it with fire, and only silver and the gold and the vessels of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. They burned everything, completely destroying it in the fire of judgment. You know, we see here that God uses fire to ultimately judge people. I want to show you three verses out of Revelation chapter 20. Actually, five verses, but three parts. Revelation 20, verse 9 and 10. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Verse 10, the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and they'll be tormented day and night forever. This is picture here at the end of the millennial reign. Everybody's been ruling and reigning with Jesus. He's on the earth. He's leading us in total peace. At the end of the 1,000 years, Satan is released from his chains, and he leads a rebellion against Jesus and against his people. And it says there, the armies, they all come, and we're going to go do the same thing that, you know, we saw in Elisha, where the armies are going to come and get him. And notice what happens. Fire comes down from heaven, devours everybody. He captures Satan and the beast and throws him into the lake of fire. Notice what the situation in the lake of fire is. They're tormented day and night forever. That's a reality, guys. Hell is bad, but the lake of fire is worse. In fact, when you get to the end, God takes hell and dumps it into the lake of fire. It burns day and night forever and ever. This burning that they started in the city in verse 24 burned until everything was consumed. Why does it burn forever and ever? Because we're all immortal. None of us are ever going to die. You're just going to move from a physical body to a spiritual body, and you'll never be consumed. You'll never be burned up. And so the fire goes day and night. And we see the same wrath and judgment of God at the end of the age that we see in this story in Joshua. God hasn't changed, not one bit. All he's done for us is he's made a way for us to get to him, just like he made a way for Rahab and her family to get to him. We've got to understand, this is God. God gets to define who he is, not us. We don't get to put God in a little box and go, that's the God I want to serve. That's the God I believe in. That's the California God. That's the America God. That's the Bill South God. I like that God because he never bums me out. He never convicts me of sin. And I would say, that's not God at all, is it? We see, what do we see from this? Here's what we see, guys. Why did God destroy Jericho? Because sin is important. It's powerful and extremely, can't even think of the word I'm trying to say. It's serious with God. So much so, as we take communion today, he sent Jesus Christ to pay for every one of your sins. Notice as you go to Revelation 20, 11, I saw a great white throne and him who sat on it. Listen, here's the picture of God from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away. You're not going to say anything to God on that day. And there was found no place for them. You can't escape from the presence of God. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God. The books were open, and another book was open, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged according to their works and by the things that were written in the books. Listen, he already cast Satan and at the end of the age into the great lake of fire. And now he's going to cast everybody who was not written in their names were not written in the Lamb's book of life. Notice this in verse 14. Then death and Hades were also cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. Verse 15. Anyone not found written in the book of life was cast in the lake of fire. How do you get your name written in the book of life? Where is Rahab's name written today? It's written in the book of life. Her testimony is an enduring testimony because she said, I believe the God of Israel. And I want to follow the God of Israel. And God took her and he goes, listen, I'm so excited about you coming into my family. I'm going to write you in my book and I'm going to write you into the line of my son who's going to come and die for everybody's sins. That's how deeply she was written in the book of life. But everybody outside the book of life, what happens to them? They're cast in the lake of fire. That's powerful, isn't it? Let's have the band come up this morning as we take communion together. Look at verse 24 here. Only the silver and gold and bronze and iron they put in the treasury of the house of the Lord. Listen, we can become treasures in the house of the Lord. How? By surrendering to this God who's revealing himself in mercy and grace. Look at the picture for the believers in Revelation 22, verse 1. He showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. In the middle of its street, on either side of the river, was the tree of life that bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the trees were for the healing of the nations. Notice the difference. People are thrown in the lake of fire, and then people are brought into the presence of God, drinking of fresh, pure water, the water of life, being able to eat off the tree of life again and taking its fruits. Look at the situation they find themselves in. Verse 3, there shall be no more curse. But the throne of God and the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him, and they shall see his face. Guys, he shall see his face. And his name shall be on their foreheads. Isn't that an amazing story? We see here as we look at this wall falling down, and that's awesome. Miracles are awesome. But the heart of God is this: I want people to come to know me. I want them to know the mercy that you've been given, the salvation you've been given. That's what I want you to go do. And when you start doing that, I'll take every wall in front of you down. And I think God is encouraging us this morning to, let's have the guys serving communion come up. I think God is encouraging us this morning that what he wants more than anything is for us to take up the mantle of sharing our faith and taking this community for the Lord, sharing Jesus Christ with every person we know. Why? Because the end of the road is a burning lake of fire. So we've got to proclaim the gospel. We've got to tell people, God will set you free. Tie the scarlet cord in your window. How do I do that? Receive Christ. God will bring you into his family, and he'll make a line and a legacy out of your life, and he'll write you in the Lamb's Book of Life.